come and see a man who told me everything I've ever done. And he called me beautiful by reason of purity of heart and life and praiseworthy. He called me true. Come see a man who has quenched my thirst. Come see a man who looked into my eyes and into my heart and said that I am pure.
That's the Reverend Mandy Sloan McDowell. And today she shares a life-giving message of faith entitled, I Drank My Fill on the Rock. I'm Peter Wallace, and this is Day One.
Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's historic Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. In 1945, we began broadcasting every week as the Protestant Hour, and since 2002, as Day One. In 2020, we proudly celebrate 75 years of sharing the good news of Jesus Christ around the world. Now, here's your host, Peter Wallace, to introduce today's preacher.
Thank you, Sherry. Today on Day One, we're pleased to welcome the Reverend Mandy Sloan McDowell, Senior Minister of Los Angeles First United Methodist Church in Los Angeles, California. Mandy is a graduate of Oglethorpe University in Atlanta, Georgia, and earned her Master of Divinity from Princeton Theological Seminary. She earlier served churches in New Jersey and Atlanta, then became Senior Minister of Laguna Beach United Methodist Church in California, where she served for 3 years before moving to L.A. in 2017. Mandy, welcome to Day One.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you've had an interesting path of ministry, to say the least, and we'll talk more about your journey this week and next, but let's start with where you are now, Los Angeles First United Methodist. It's a church with a long, rich history, founded in 1853, but today it has no building. Where do you meet now and why?
It's a great question. We meet in a parking lot. Mm-hmm. The reason why is because we own it. That makes it very easy for us to attain access. Many years ago, the church had a very lovely, large, gracious building that they had worked very hard to earn the money for, pay for in full. It was the most expensive building built in downtown Los Angeles in the 1920s. But by the 1960s, as the city's inner workings were shifting and changing, the community had started to move elsewhere, and the church was no longer able to afford its huge building. And despite the fact that they'd done a lot of creative things to make use of the property, they simply couldn't afford it, and they made the very difficult decision to sell it to the gas company. So now the gas company lofts reside where Los Angeles First United Methodist Church used to be. And they wisely bought a new piece of property. It was an office building. They converted the downstairs into a beautiful sanctuary space. And they used that as long as they were able, up until the point that that building was too expensive as well. And in the early 2000s, they made a pretty courageous and bold decision to tear it down, with the hopes of raising money to build a church. Well, the economic downturn didn't help that at all. And as Los Angeles continued to shift, it was very challenging to try and raise money. So now we are sitting on a paved surface parking lot that happens to be a block away from the Staples Center. The church had been meeting indoors for a number of years at a multi-purpose room of a senior housing facility. And when I arrived in 2017, it was clear we had to do something differently that wasn't a generative model for evangelism. So we moved outside and we set up pop-up tents in our parking lot, and it's transformed everything.
So a church without walls, without borders, without barriers, reflecting your theological openness and the way you believe God's love should be experienced and shared. I love that. But I imagine you face a lot of challenges as well. It never rains in Southern California, but still.
It did Sunday. we do have challenges. I joke that I've become a street preacher. I did a lot of thinking and wondering and praying about what happens when you take ministry outdoors. There are certain times of year that we do things in an unusual way. Easter Vigil is one of them. But typically your Easter Vigil is held outdoors on a church property, and it's evident that this is a sacred ritual. And so we don't think a lot about it. But moving outdoors every week on a street corner in the middle of a busy downtown and urban environment meant that we had to consider exterior noise, the fact that people can walk by at any point in any condition, that we had to be prepared to be hospitable. not only for our own congregation and those coming to worship, but also for the fact that we were setting up in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So how were we going to be good neighbors? And one of the choices we've made is to ensure that we're offering food and coffee every week, that anyone is free to take as much as they need, within some level of reason, so that we can be good neighbors. And also, we don't expect a lot in return. And that's established a sense of rapport and respect with our community that's been really helpful.
In this time of great change in the church, do you think this model is something others should emulate? It has to be an incredibly difficult decision to do what your church did, but is it a possible way of the future?
I absolutely think so. I mean, one of the things that we enjoy is that we have stripped away a lot of the pretense and hypocrisy about what happens indoors and where the money goes. Mm-hmm. We're very clear on where the money goes and where it comes from. Our greatest tither is the parking lot. So I never have to worry that she doesn't like the hymns. She's always there. Mm-hmm. She's very reliable. It means, because we have the certain environmental consideration that we do, obviously, if you have a church in St. Paul, Minnesota, you can't meet in a parking lot every week. But there is something you could do that is radically different that would serve your community in a way where most of the time we're feeding our buildings, where we're feeding properties that don't give back to us in the same way that we nurture them. And that's an unfair balance of resources. So if churches are able to reconsider how they want to use their resources and what it truly means to love God and love our neighbor, and see that as the pathway to discipleship, as opposed to just banking everything on Sunday worship attendance. That's also a pretty flawed way to measure discipleship. Every church can do that and just figure out what it looks like in their particular community.
Mm-hmm. Mandy, you actually, after graduating from seminary, began a master's in sacred music and voice, but your plans changed. What happened?
I am not a church musician. What happened was I got appointed to a church, and simultaneously I was pastoring a church in New Jersey and trying to go to school to do this master's in sacred music. And I had a wonderful, wonderful set of experiences with that. And I love music, and I love being able to utilize this gift every week. But it was very clear where my passion was and where my energy and work was being drawn, and it was back to the local church. So I had at that point the training I needed to be able to be a competent musician and to utilize that in worship every week. And I still get to. I don't know if I'm annoying to every church musician I work with or not, but I have a high value for that. So it was really just clear where my effort, time, and focus needed to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, we continue in the season of Lent, and for this third Sunday, your sermon is based on John chapter 4. Would you read the passage for us?
I would. John chapter 4, verses 5 through 26. So he came to a Samaritan city called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired out by his journey, was sitting by the well. It was about noon. A Samaritan woman came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." His disciples had gone to the city to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask a drink of me, a woman of Samaria?" Jews do not share things in common with Samaritans. Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God, and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." The woman said to him, "Sir, you have no bucket, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our ancestor Jacob, who gave us this well, and with his sons and his flocks drank from it?" Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But those who drink of the water that I will give will never be thirsty. The water that I will give will become in them a spring of water gushing up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I may never be thirsty or have to keep coming here to draw water." Jesus said to her, "Go call your husband and come back." The woman answered him, "I have no husband." Jesus said to her, "You are right in saying, 'I have no husband,' for you have had five husbands, and the one you have now is not your husband. What you have said is true. The woman said to him, Sir, I see that you are a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you say that the place where people must worship is in Jerusalem. Jesus said to her, Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You worship what you do not know, but we worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming, and is now here, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father seeks such as these to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. The woman said to him, I know that Messiah is coming, who is called Christ. When he comes, he will proclaim all things to us. Jesus said to her, I am he, the one who is speaking to you.
A powerful midday encounter between Jesus and this Samaritan woman. Mandy, your sermon on this is entitled, I Drank My Fill on the Rock. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Thank you. The Red Rose by the Everybody Fields. I went walking one day down the dusty trail in the mountains. I saw your fence and climbed it down to the ground. On the ground I walked, and on the rock there was your still. There was your still. There's a bar in Alabama. It's called the Red Rose. I go there when I'm thirsty. That's the only reason, I suppose. And there was a man beside me. For 10 long years, I stayed at home. But that man has gone and left me to do some drinking on his own. I think God is a moonshiner. His skin is gold from the whiskey in his blood. I think in heaven there's a bar room, a place where the men go. Forget about their wives. The sun rises when I'm drinking, and it sets when I'm asleep. And I'll drag my loneliness to the next bar that I see. I think God is a moonshiner. His skin is gold from the whiskey in his blood. I think in heaven there's a bar room. A place where the men go and forget about their wives. I know, I have had enough of this town. There's not much more for me to see. And there's Bibles falling from the skies down here. And I don't think God has time for me. I think God is a moonshiner. His skin is gold from the whiskey in his blood. I think in heaven there's a bar room, a place where the men go and forget about their wives. I walked to your still, and I drank my fill on the rock. If I were the woman at the well, I can imagine this song serving as my anthem as I trudged in the heat of the midday Sicarian sun to Jacob's well. This is a woman whose life has not been kind to her. I can imagine that the lines on her face betray a sense of age and world weariness far beyond her years. One day, as she heaves her stone water jug onto her tired shoulders and walks to the source of her refreshment. The jug that she carries is left over as a wedding gift from days gone by. From her first marriage? Those beginning days, like the beginning measures of this poem, are filled with hope and simplicity. But her song quickly becomes melancholy as we learn of the woman's continued search for something to quench her thirst. There was her first husband, a good man, a hard worker, whose continued stumbling finally led him out of her life. For a while, there was a man, and for 10 years she stayed at home, nurturing children, cleaning house, cooking. But now that man is gone, and she is left with her children to raise and a secondary husband to stand in. A virus runs through the village. He is gone. A third husband, a cousin of the last one, thinks he'll do the right thing, but her sorrow and constant thirst are too much for him. He signs a bill of divorce and leaves her. A fourth man, a neighbor, too old to consider marriage, succumbs to the bigness of his own heart. Then a fifth, who shares only her love of wine, quickly finds her unfit for a real life together. By now, her children are grown, married, and far off. She shares a home with another man who cares not for her presence or absence, only that she bring him water each day. If we are concerned about the view of God that history has created, think of the picture this woman must hold. This woman who worshipped on the mountain can only see God as the great moonshiner in the sky, concocting the finest whiskey to ruin livers and cleanse sinners through the dialysis of reverence and sacrifice. Her God is the great designer of a world in which women like this are brought in just close enough to feel the incredible sting as they are left behind, abandoned, sent away, forgotten about. If heaven is truly a place where the men go and forget about their wives, then what hope is there for her? Her thirst for true love will never be quenched. Perhaps on this particular day, as the Samaritan woman drags her jug to the well, she has no intent to return back home. After all, the town is filled with critical stares, whispered insults, sympathetic and judgmental faces. There are Bibles fallen from the sky down here. Perhaps on this day of days, she is walking to the well to continue down the road past the red rose and out of Sychar for good. But instead of finding an abandoned well, she finds a man, a Jewish man, an enemy. Clearly, God hasn't got time for her. In her darkest moment, her hour of decision, she is faced not with compassion, but with an adversary. That is, until he deems to speak to her. "Give me a drink." Something in his tone must have suggested to her that this was not a man of the patriarchal system of submission and dominance. Something in his voice must have sounded kind, compassionate, weary. She boldly asks, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask a drink of me, a woman of Samaria?" The parenthetical statement in our translation explains that Jews do not have dealings with Samaritans, even in matters of thirst and hunger. But he continues, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." In Greek, this phrase is hydrozoon, living water, which has vital power in itself and exerts the same power upon the soul. This is a nice attempt at a definition of something we can't possibly understand. So she responds with clarity, despite the cryptic nature of his statement, "Sir, you have no bucket, and the well is deep. Where do you get this living water?" How right she is. Her observation that this man can provide something for her without the proper tools is spot on. She knows that this is no ordinary Jewish person standing at the well where Jacob met Rachel, where their love bloomed into generation upon generation. Perhaps now the woman gets an understanding of what it is to be loved. After so many attempts at failed love and false devotion, it seems that this chance meeting at the well might become something that would be life-altering. What Jesus promises next is the end to her toil and wrestling. "Those who drink of the water that I will give them will never be thirsty." The nights and days that she's spent parched and dry, hungering and thirsting, trudging with the same heavy jug, all of that can come to an end. The shame of leaving her house at noon in the bright of day can cease. Whatever this living water is, she is willing to try it. Sir, give me this water so that I may never be thirsty or have to keep coming here to draw water. Sir, whoever you are, rid me of my shame. Please remove my guilt, my struggle, my pain. Please take this thirst from me. Point me down a different path. I no longer want to go to the Red Rose when I'm thirsty. Here is her confession, her invocation, her willingness to participate in the life that God has created for her. The life that she has led up to now hasn't served her heart well. This is her moment of justification, the awakening of her senses to the presence of God in her life. We are about to witness a full-blown conversion. But Jesus takes a funny next step. Go call your husband and come back. Without missing a beat, she offers the proper response. I have no husband. Jesus is impressed. He responds to her, kalos. But kalos in the sense doesn't simply mean true. It means beautiful by reason of purity and heart and life, and hence praiseworthy. This has never been the response when she says, I have no husband. If ever Jesus put someone to the test, it was in this instance. And if ever there were words this woman needed to hear, it was these. Do you think anyone has ever called her beautiful by reason of purity or praiseworthy for any reason? Slowly, Jesus was restoring this woman to her full humanity, he, a foreigner, acknowledging her presence and power as she approached the well. He inquired of her to help him with his own need, offering her the power and the ability to say yes or no. Then he offers her a welcome into the kingdom with a sip of living water. Finally, he sets aside her shame as she offers her simple confession. Without judgment or condemnation, he speaks clearly to her circumstances and acknowledges her humanity and dignity in the midst of it. In turn, we see the moment of conversion come to full fruition. The woman exclaims, Sir, I see you are a prophet. She then asks where she is to worship now that she has come to know the promised one of the Israelites. But Jesus promises her that everyone who worships will do so differently. The hour is coming and is now here when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father seeks these to worship him. But for this woman to worship in spirit and truth, that would require a radical shift in her perception of herself, of her neighbors, of God Almighty. How could she, a Samaritan, even begin to entertain the idea of worshiping the God of the Israelites in spirit and truth? The first step is to hop on board with the rumors she's heard. I know the Messiah is coming, who is called Christ. When he comes, he will proclaim all things to us. I have no doubt that Jesus' next statement comes as little surprise to her. After all, this is a woman who has had many dealings with men. And after so many rounds of proposals, or at least indifferent resignation, she's decided to spend the next part of her life with one man or another. Few things surprise her in this conversation. But the word that's spoken by Jesus is not a half-hearted or well-meaning promise of companionship. The word that's spoken by Jesus is not an invitation to join him at temple next week. The word spoken by Jesus is the Word made flesh, dwelling among us. I am the one who is speaking to you. These words are full of spirit and truth, the truth of the gospel of God's love, of grace and acceptance. With this single utterance, Jesus redeems this woman without gimmicky or empty promises. He turns society as she knows it on its head and restores her to the beloved community. The disciples' return doesn't do anything but confirm that something otherworldly has happened here. No one said, What do you want? Or why are you speaking with her? The power of spirit and truth sends the woman back to her village, running with her head held high, her useless water jug left behind. She looks her neighbors in the eye and says, "Come and see a man who told me everything I've ever done. He cannot be the Messiah, can he?" And for some reason, they followed. With a word spoken in spirit and truth, the woman is bold enough to shout her prayers of thanksgiving and confession to those who have hurt her, shunned her, ignored and upset her. Now that the word has been made flesh and is dwelling among them at their own well, something is different. Her moment of justification cannot pass her by without her need to share it with all whom she knows, and she shouts with confidence, "Come and see a man who told me everything I've ever done, and he called me beautiful by reason of purity of heart and life, and praiseworthy. He called me true. Come see a man who has quenched my thirst. Come see a man who looked into my eyes and into my heart and said that I am pure. He saw everything I've ever done and called it beautiful." A word spoken in spirit and truth took away her shame. A word spoken in spirit and truth restored her to her community. A word spoken in spirit and truth quenched her thirst for true love. "I walked to your still, and I drank my fill on the rock." Amen.
Skin is gold from the whiskey in his blood.
Our preacher today was the Reverend Mandy Sloan McDowell, senior pastor of First United Methodist Church in Los Angeles, California. For a free printed transcript of her message, "I Drank My Fill on the Rock," call us at 404-815-9110. That's 404-815-9110. Or write to us at Day 1, 2715 Peachtree Road, Atlanta, Georgia 30305. Day 1 is made possible by the generous contributions of listeners like you. If you appreciate what you hear, please send a donation. We're grateful for your much-needed support. I'm Sherry Miller. Next week, the Reverend Mandy McDowell returns to Day 1 with a powerful sermon for the fourth Sunday in Lent entitled, "One Thing I Do Know." You won't want to miss it. The 2020 Festival of Homiletics will be May 18th through the 22nd in Atlanta, Georgia. Preachers, you won't want to miss this year's stellar lineup of outstanding church leaders. For information, visit festivalofhomiletics.com. Now, Mandy McDowell offers some final reflections on today's message with our host, Peter Wallace.
Mandy, you painted a portrait of this Samaritan woman, hard-edged, used up, just going through the motions, and you wondered how she must view God. There are so many people living all around us, perhaps listening right now, who have deep struggles and pains in their lives, not unlike this woman, people thirsty for some hint of God. What would this woman tell them now, do you think?
What a thoughtful question. I think the beauty of her particular story is the immediacy with which she receives the blessing that she has been seen and known. No secrets, no pretense, that Jesus tells her everything she's ever done and still affirms who she is. And truly, I think that deep down, everybody wants that same level of acceptance and affirmation, that the very people that we are, who we are created to be, who we stumble into being, who we, you know, completely screw up and become, all of that is considered beloved. And from that point, we can start to build a life that reflects this belovedness. I think she would have a message that really resonates with our understanding of grace.
Hmm. I love your translation of Jesus's response to her statement, "I have no husband." The NRSV says you're right in saying that. It's true. But there's more to it in the original Greek you pointed out. He's saying, "You are beautiful by reason of purity of heart and life, and hence praiseworthy." I wonder if this woman had ever heard such language directed at her, and it makes an impact, it seems. What does that tell us about the power of our words with others?
I think it tells us that they matter.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's one thing that I try to take from any text I read, is that the words were chosen with great intention.
Mm-hmm.
And the way in which we communicate truly matters. One of the things we see now is the value of things like inclusive language and mm-hmm. how we refer to people and care around pronouns. These things make a difference. They make a difference in how we are viewed, how we are valued, how we communicate our identity, and how we are seen by one another.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in that, just that one encapsulated moment, Jesus is able to accomplish so much of what we fail at doing, mm-hmm. which is to see, honor, value, and respect the other.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a good reminder to us to choose our words wisely, especially when we're feeling hurt or frustrated or angry, that those words can really go a long way to damage. But obviously, in this moment, what we see is the power of one healing word to resolve so much of that.
Mandy, what's one thing from your sermon today that you hope our listeners will keep in mind in the days ahead?
I think it's this idea that anyone we see is greater than what is presented to us initially.
Hmm.
The woman at the well is an iconic figure in Scripture because she can be easily painted into a person of ill repute.
Mm-hmm.
We have surmised a lot of things about her story, her backstory, and frankly, so have I as the preacher. What Jesus does in naming her and giving her some context for us is not an invitation to judge her. It's an invitation to see who she is despite what her history has demonstrated. And I think that's the invitation, that we simply look each other in the eye and see one another for the pure value of who we are as created children of God. That's what I hope people take away.
Mandy McDowell, thank you for being with us, and we look forward to having you back next week.
Thank you. I look forward to it.
Celebrating 75 years of ministry, Day One is the voice of America's historic Protestant churches. Visit us online at dayone.org. Our program is recorded and edited by Donald Jones and produced by Peter Wallace. Thank you for listening. I'm Sherry Miller wishing you all God's blessings on Day One and forever.